Good morning, everyone. It is March 10th, and we are late in the book of Judges. We're at the beginning of chapter 19, entering into the final story, which spans these last three chapters, Judges 19, 20, and 21. I'm sure that this will take us a couple of weeks, and then we'll have a very comfortable space of time to look at the book of Ruth before this year finishes out. Remember that just as Judges had a double introduction, it has a double conclusion. Last Sunday, somewhat to my surprise, we covered the entire first conclusion of the book, chapter 17 and 18, in the space of a single class period. I'm not known for that sort of speed and alacrity, but there we are. So we're ready to start the second conclusion, although I will say something to tie them together. They're not one story by any means, but they do serve a tandem purpose. Remember that in chapter 17 and 18, we had this young Levite who comes into the service of a man named Micah, who is clearly not the most upright of fellows, stole from his mother, made household gods, seemed to collect them to the point where he decided he needed his own priest, so he ordained his son, who could not be a priest under the law because he wasn't a Levite. This is in Ephraim. So when the Levite wanders along, he hires him. And the Levite is happy to do so, and he should not be happy to do so, because he is now violating the law of God as well. And then the third player comes in, this faction of the tribe of Dan that has decided, since Dan, back in Judges 1 and 2, is having so much trouble taking the land allotted to them, this group of 600 and their families decides, well, we're going to go find some land that's easier to take. And ignoring God's word, they send out spies who wander north, and ultimately they'll end up taking land way, way, way up to the north in what is on the maps part of East Manasseh, but it's so far up toward the frontier that it might not even be part of Israel's allotment. I'm not sure. Either way, they break the law because they're either taking land that was given by God to someone else in Israel, or they fail to follow the protocols that God laid down for attacking an enemy city, a far-off city, where they should have offered peace first, and they don't. They find an unsuspecting, peaceful little place far away from their fellow Sidonians, and they ambush it and take it and burn it and build their own new town. And they take Micah's idols, because they'd come across him and the Levite on their way north. They take the Levite with them, they take the idols with them, they set those idols up, and for the entire time that the tabernacle is at Shiloh, they're worshiping using these idols way up there in the very northern reaches of Israel. So it's not a pretty story. There are no heroes in the story. There are no good guys. There's not even a great deal of plot, except that I guess the main thread is this faction of Dan that's trying to find land their own way. If you weren't here, we also noted that for all these times that the book of Judges talks about Israel having no king and doing what was right in its own eyes, that is actually language tied back to Deuteronomy, where God exhorts Israel Don't do what's right in your own eyes. Do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. So every time the author of Judges talks about Israel doing what is right in its own eyes, it's an indictment against their violating that word to do what is right in the eyes of Yahweh back in Deuteronomy. And that's an element or a facet of that language that we had not seen before. The thing that is the most, I think, important about that whole story is that it shows how widespread Israel's decay was, how far-reaching, and I don't mean geographically, although Dan certainly reached pretty far geographically. I mean culturally, societally, how widespread their waywardness from God's law had become. You have the citizen Micah, a man of some means, who's decided to invent his own religion, which may have been a modified and inappropriate worship of Yahweh, but with all those household idols, it probably was more than that. You have his mother, who thinks that the most wonderful thing to do with some of the stolen money that is returned to her is to set it aside to make idols. You have this young Levite, whose unemployment is its own indictment of the society, but who's perfectly willing to compromise his standards as one of the spiritual leaders of the people in order to get gainful employment. And remember, we have the surprise reveal at the end of the story that this nameless Levite actually has a name, and he is Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses himself. So it's Moses' grandson who is also part of this waywardness. And we see it, so we see it in the citizenry, we see it in the priesthood, and we see it at the tribal level, where this significant faction of Dan is willing to abandon what the Lord has given them, what the Lord has told them to do, what the Lord has promised to help them do, and go and find their own way to do it. So it's a story that shows the breadth of Israel's waywardness and departure from the will of God. The second conclusion that we're going to start looking at today doesn't look at the breadth, it looks at the depth and how deeply Israel's, I call it waywardness, but in this story we're going to be able to genuinely call it depravity, has sunk. So, let's turn to Judges 19. This is a difficult text to read. It's not just one like Ehud gutting Eglon and the rather indelicate results of Eglon's intestines being perforated. It's going to be a challenge with that music in the next room. Not to mention a bit incongruous, because that's rather pleasant, happy music. This is not a pleasant, happy story. Where was I? It's a hard story to read, and it's not a particularly fun story to teach. But it's here. And I've seen too many times where people make the choice to just skip over the difficult parts. We need to look this in the eye, because there are some extremely important lessons that we need to get from this story, both in terms of what it has to say to Israel of its day and for what it has to say about what has happened in Israel's past before, and what it has to say, although it's much more subtle, about what's coming in Israel's future. So, Judges chapter 19. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and at this point you can almost supply the rest of the text just from memory. He doesn't actually say, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. but I would almost argue that it's implied now automatically. In those days when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. So we're in the hill country of Ephraim again, just like we were at the beginning of the other story. And where that story started with Micah and eventually introduced a Levite, this one starts with a Levite. It's not Jonathan. We never learned this Levite's name. But he, like everyone else in this story, like everyone else in the previous two chapters, is no hero. There are still no good guys in this story. The literary structure of good versus evil is really missing here. It's evil versus evil. And the will of God being defied at every turn by every party. But a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Well, there's our first problem. We have a Levite with a concubine. That's not supposed to happen. And his concubine, now this depends on your Bible translation. It will either say his concubine was unfaithful to him, which is what the Greek Septuagint says, or it will say his concubine was angry with him, which is what the Hebrew says. And it doesn't really matter, because the point is that she left him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and she was there for some 4 months. So they had a falling out. I'm not sure how a concubine can be unfaithful. That's kind of by definition already there. But either way. And he decides that he wants to go back down and reconcile with her. So then her husband, put quotes around that, it's the Levite, arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw the Levite, he came with joy to meet him. There's our second problem. The young lady's father is delighted that she's somebody's concubine. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days, which is kind of a default hospitality time interval. I'm resisting the comments to talk about how good it would be if 3 days was sort of the normal limit for family visits. And yet there I just said it, didn't I? So, I'm in the middle of verse 4. They ate and drank and spent the night there, really 3 nights there. And on the fourth day, verse 5, they arose early in the morning and prepared to go. Because that's kind of the point at which you've started to risk overstaying your welcome, traditionally. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, said to the Levite, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry. And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. So, clearly not overstaying their welcome as far as the father-in-law is concerned. Nah, stick around. Let's get a good breakfast in you. Let's sit and chat the afternoon away. Oh, we should get some dinner. You know, it's really late. You should just stay. That's what's happening here. And on the fifth day, he arose early in the morning to depart, and the girl's father said, strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines. Here we go again. For some reason, he doesn't want this guy to go. Maybe it's that he's just genuinely fond of him. Maybe it's that he finds some prestige in having him as a guest. Remember how excited Micah was to get a real Levite. But we really don't know the circumstances here. So they ate, both of them, verse 9, and when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here, let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go home. Same thing he tried successfully to pull the day before. But the Levite would not spend the night, verse 10. He rose up and departed, even though it was late. He rose up doesn't mean he got up in the middle of the night and snuck away. He rose up does not mean that he got up early the next morning and left. It just means he stood up. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And that's the reason I don't have any maps today, because all of this takes place around Jerusalem. So you kind of know where we are. He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. So he succeeded in getting her back from her father's home. By the way, depending on what kind of a fallout this Levite and his concubine actually had, we don't know how she feels about this situation. He comes to fetch her 4 months later. Maybe she's glad to see him. Maybe she'd like to get back together. Maybe she's not. But her dad is sure happy to see him. And suddenly, her father and her former whatever term would apply are just as happy as can be to socialize, and now she's on the way back, whether she wants to or not. We don't know whether she wants to or not. I think we can safely say she's going to regret it later, but she might regret it already. Verse 11. When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. And his master said to him, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah. Don't want to stay with some Gentile city.
It might have been better off.
That's beneath us. And he said to the young man, come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah. Now, just for perspective, Gibeah is just 3 or 4 miles north of Jerusalem. And Ramah is a little farther north than that. Gibeah is in Benjamin territory. So you're right where these tribes have close borders. Jerusalem is in northern Judah. Gibeah, just 4 miles away, is in Benjamin. And Ramah, just a little bit farther north, is actually across the border in Dan. So he wants to get to Gibeah or Ramah. So they passed on, verse 14, and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. I just said that. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Now let me pause there. This is a cultural thing. If you were a visitor, a sojourner, just passing through, and you needed some place to spend the night, you would go to the town square. Just as the city gates were where the elders would gather in the morning and have their meetings and smoke their cigars and decide business for the town. I'm just kidding about the cigar part, as far as I know. The town square was where a sojourner would go. And it was understood that if someone was in the town square, obviously most of the townspeople somewhere along the way are passing through there, would recognize an odd term to say for it, but it's the best I've got, would recognize an unfamiliar face, realize this is an unfamiliar face, and offer hospitality. That was the custom. So this Levite has gone to the town square, but no one has offered him any hospitality. Granted, it's already late in the day, but still, that's a failing on the part of the townspeople of Gibeah. It's not the worst failing on the part of the townspeople of Gibeah, as we're about to find out, and as I think many of you know. But at this point, I want to stop and move back to another story, because this bit about the town square and the hospitality custom that's kind of underlying it without being stated is the first point of parallel to a story in Genesis 19. So let's take a look back at Genesis 19 for a few moments. And if you didn't know it before you got there, you know by now, this is part of the story of Abraham, and more specifically in this case, Lot and his family, who are living in the city of Sodom. And let's just look quickly at the first part of the story. We're not going to look at all of it. These two angels who had been visiting Abraham came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." They said, "No, we will spend the night in the town square." So they're saying, "Thanks for your hospitality offer, but we'll just go and follow the custom, sit in the town square. I mean, if nobody comes, at least you're in the middle of town and fairly safe. But see who comes and shows us hospitality." But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." It's a nice King James euphemism that the ESV continues to use. "Bring them out that we may have sex with them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you." Oh, gee, thanks, Dad. "Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please." There needs to be something said about the view of women in this culture, and I think we will before we're done with this whole lesson. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof. Like your daughters weren't under the shelter. Okay, never mind. I'll just keep grousing about that every time. But the men of the city said, stand back, or in other words, get out of our way. And they said, this fellow came to sojourn. That would be Lot, originally showed up as a sojourner. And he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. Then they pressed hard against the man Lot, basically pushed him aside, drew near to break the door down. But the men, the angelic visitors, reached out their hand, brought Lot into the house with them, shut the door, and they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both great and small, so that they wore themselves out, groping for the door. And that's as much as we need to read there. Sodom, of course, then falls under ultimate divine judgment. Those visitors ask Lot, how much family do you have here? Get them, leave, do it now, because this city's about to be destroyed. And Lot actually, it's kind of funny, Lot actually tarries until they physically grab him and his family and shove them out the door and tell them, get out of town, do it now. And of course, we know Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by fire and judgment from God. All right, so let's go back to Judges 19. Because the story is lamentably, tragically, horribly parallel. Not just in terms of hospitality and how it relates to the town square, but in terms of how the people of Gibeah behave. So we were in Judges 19. We just read verse 15. They went to the town square, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. So unlike Lot, who was at the city gates and offered hospitality right away, no one did that. So the Levite brings his little entourage into the town square. And behold, an old man, verse 16, was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. So he's a lot like Lot. The men of the place were Benjaminites. And given how close the borders are here, this is a sliver of Benjamin with Dan to the north and Judah to the south, it's easy to understand how you could have this sort of mix where the man actually is an Ephraimite. And the man lifted up his eyes, verse 17, and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going? And where do you come from? And the Levite said to him, we're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to the house of the Lord. So he's on his way to Shiloh. I'm on my way to the house of the Lord could also translate as I'm on my way to Bethel. But no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys, so it's not as if someone taking us in would need to go out of his way or deplete his own pantry. With bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants, there is no lack of anything. And the old man said, peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. So they do get hospitality ultimately. Just as Lot showed hospitality to the visitors. Verse 22 is where it really turns south, though. As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have sex with him. This is just like the Sodom story. And it is precisely why the writer, as you know, I think it's Samuel, has put it here. He wants to show that Israel's departure from the will of God, that their waywardness from the life that God would have them lead, has gone so far that they have now reached the depths of the worst story they themselves know about the Canaanites. Because it was Canaanites, Amorites, in Genesis 19. And now, while Judges has been saying all along, they intermarried with them, they took up their worship, they took up their customs, they tolerated them, they accommodated. Now it's showing us that they have gone down to the lowest level that the Canaanites have ever been known to reach. This is Israel's Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 23, and the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Can you see how parallel to the story in Genesis 19 this is? Even in details, going out to the men. Doesn't say he closed the door behind him. The words he says to them to try to dissuade them are almost the same. And then he makes a comparable offer. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and my guest's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. Wonderful. Mistreating the women is okay if necessary, but don't mistreat the guest. But the men would not listen to him, and this time we're not talking about divine visitors who can stretch out their hand and strike everyone blind. So now the stories diverge. I'm at verse 25. But the men outside would not listen to him. So the man, this is the Levite now, still inside the house, seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her. They had sex with her, that is to say. And abused her all night until the morning. So she is gang raped all night long. That's the blunt, horrid, simple truth of it. Not the homeowner's daughter, by the way. Notice that she ends up being left out of this. Just the concubine. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. And her master rose up in the morning. This guy's a piece of work. And when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's be going." He doesn't say, "Oh, you made it back. I'm so relieved." He doesn't say, "Hey, are you all right?" He doesn't say, "What did those awful people do to you?" He says, "Will you get up? It's time to go." This is a pastor, if you will, of Israel. But there was no answer. Then he put her on the, because she's dead. Just let's be clear here. She's dead. And, I mean, that's all horrid and dreadful and very intentionally evocative of Genesis 19. And yet, the story's perhaps, if possible, going to get a little worse. He put her on the donkey, and the man, the Levite, rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day of the people, the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak." So even the people across the tribes readily note that this is as bad as it's ever been. And sadly, one more sadly upon another, we're going to find out later, with a reference to who was serving as the priest at the time, the high priest, that this is not late in the period of the judges. Like the last story where we were in the generation of Moses' grandson, we're still in about that same generation. We're in the generation of Aaron's grandson, so this is relatively early in the period of the judges, and it's this bad. It's going to raise Israel to action. They're going to unite in a way like they have not united since the conquest. While Judges has shown us these indications through the various stories of the judges of an Israel that slowly begins to even lose its tribal identities, and we have people like Abimelech who's governing a city region that is spanning more than one tribal allotment. Other indications of people, some of the judges of whom we have almost no details, with 30 sons who rode 30 white donkeys and ruled 30 cities, get these ideas of city-states, very much like the Canaanites had their governments organized into. But here, Israel comes together. We're going to see that now in a way like they don't anywhere else after Judges 1 and 2. And how pathetic that this is what it took to pull them together.
Well, I kind of don't get it, right? Because, I mean, the concubine not being of any stature, if you will, right?
Yep.
Her getting killed, I don't understand that piece of why this started the fire. You know what I mean? The unknown woman, you know, why this is the thing. That's what's so strange to me is that this is the act that does it, as opposed to anything else that came before. This is the one.
Well, first of all, remember that we're not sure what came before and what came after because Judges isn't linear in its chronology. But you raise a good question. Why is this the precipitating thing? Why is this the one that catalyzes some reaction across all the tribes? Well, in part because this is the one where there is actually communication out to all the tribes when he dismembers her body and sends the pieces out. There had to be more than just the pieces. There had to be a story. There had to be a scroll. There had to be something that would lead Israel to understand that something horrible had happened, that they needed to all converge. They converge at Mizpah. And it's going to be interesting to see the story that this Levite tells. Because it's not going to be the same story that we just read. But ultimately, this is Israelite against Israelite. Even if she was only a concubine, she was the concubine of a Levite. She herself was from Bethlehem. Maybe Canaanite, maybe Israelite. We don't know for sure. But the Levite was Israelite. And the men of the city were Benjaminites. That we know. So Israelite has raised hand against Israelite. And I think that is the reason why that plus the shockingly graphic way in which the Levite responded. And by the way, let's talk about that too for a minute. Is this righteous anger on the part of the Levite? I don't think so. And we're going to find out that he conveniently leaves details out of the story once all of Israel is gathered together and they say, okay, tell us what happened here. He's going to conveniently leave out details that make him look bad. The way he presumes upon his concubine, the way that he lies, although we haven't seen it yet, about the story, it's very hard to look at this, I think, and see his motives as being remotely pure. This is a matter of pride for him. This is a matter of someone having abused, defaced, and destroyed his property. That's what he's upset about. More's the pity. Oh, let's not confuse it with details like that. But yes, property that he put out there himself. This is going to thrust Israel into civil war. So, let's cross into chapter 20 for a bit. And by the way, keep in mind what Samuel's trying to accomplish here. Twofold. In fact, I'll just go ahead and give this away now because we've already had this horrible thing happen at Gibeah. First of all, Samuel is pointing out that this is every bit as bad as anything that the Canaanites ever did. And what happened to the Canaanites when they acted this way? They were destroyed by fire. And the implicit message is, Israel, you deserve the same thing. You are no better. Secondly, remember that Samuel is writing this history in part to demonstrate to Israel why they need a king like David. But of course, who was the king before David?
Saul.
And who chose Saul to be the king? The people. And where did Saul reign? I'll give you a hint. It wasn't Jerusalem, because as the story just said, Jerusalem was called Jebus at this time, because the Jebusites still lived there. Who finally conquered Jebus, made it Jerusalem, and made it the capital?
David.
Saul did not rule from Jerusalem, because Jerusalem wasn't Jerusalem yet. For all of his 38 years, Saul reigned from Gibeah. This is the town where this horrible, horrible thing happened. This is where Saul would reign from for his 38 years as king. There's a subtle underlying message here too. All right. Chapter 20. Somewhere in every tribe of Israel, someone has brought in the FedEx box from his front porch and received a horrible surprise. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, which, remember, is across in the east. There's a lot of times we don't hear about the Transjordan tribes, but it's expressly stated here, including the land of Gilead. So this is not just the western tribes that so often are prominent in the story. The eastern tribes are responding as well. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot. Which is kind of an odd phrase, because they didn't have chariots and they didn't have horses anyway. If you were an Israelite soldier, you were a foot soldier. Anyway, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. How could they not, really? And the people of Israel said, "Tell us, how did this evil happen?" And the Levite, the quote-unquote husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, and let's listen to his story, "I came to Gibeah, that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me." Did they? Was it the leaders? In the Sodom story, it's every single man in the city. In this story, it just says the men of the city. We don't know. "They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead." Boy, that glossed over a whole bunch that happened there at the front porch. "So I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel." Which I hope is just tragically hilarious to read against the background of all the things that every single character in these stories at the end of Judges are doing. Yes, this is an abomination. Yes, this is an outrage. But it's not this great black stain against a white background. There have been plenty of abominations and outrages happening. the abomination of false worship. And ambushing a city that was just living its life up on the northern frontier. Or having a concubine at all when you're a priest of Israel. But they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. And all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. We're not just going to go home. We're going to do something. Verse 9, but now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000, to bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. So they're going to send 10% of their forces because they don't need 400,000 soldiers to take out the town of Gibeah. So they're going to do it by lot, no pun intended, and send 40,000. And the tribes of Israel, verse 12, sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin. Which, if you do look at a map, is not a big tribe. Geographically, Benjamin is not a lot of territory. It may be the smallest. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? Now, therefore, give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. But the Benjaminites decided that blood is thicker than water. The Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. Then the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities to Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. So it's 11 tribes against one. And Benjamin decides to put up a united front to defend Gibeah. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. Among all these, don't think it's just the 700 from Gibeah. It happens to be 700, but it's not the Gibeonites. Among all these were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. And the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of war. We've seen a left-handed Benjaminite before. That was Ehud in the second story of Judges, the second judge, the bagman with the shiv. He was left-handed. And that was part of why what he did to Eglon worked. Maybe it's a thing. Men of Ephraim can't pronounce Shibboleth. Maybe left-handedness runs stronger in Benjamin. The people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God. And I think maybe that's where we should pause. The war itself is about to break out. But if I go any farther, it's going to be kind of in the middle and a bad breaking point. So let's pause there. Any other thoughts or questions on your in your minds before we go farther into this? Or before we break until next week when we go farther into this? All right, then. Let's close in prayer. Father, it is hard to look at this story and see what sort of evil could take root and grow and blossom among your people. But we each know that the truth is we're capable of just as much evil ourselves. And if we don't like to look at it in this story in Judges, it's easier sometimes than looking at it in ourselves. Grant that we would be able to see the evil in our own lives, the ways in which we have turned away from your will, and be turned back. We pray in Jesus' name.